Okay, we have with us today for our first press briefing following the recovery, from your left, Dr. George Lowe, Deputy Administrator of NASA, Mr. Dale D. Myers, Associate Administrator for Manned Space Flight, Dr. Rocco Patrone, the Apollo Program Director, Dr. Chris Kraft, Deputy Director of the Manned Spacecraft Center, Dr. Eberhard Ries, Director of the Marshall Space Flight Center. And we will begin this with a few remarks by Dr. Lowe.
Good afternoon. I never know how to begin these statements, because the only word I can think of is the one that Dave and Jim and Al used around the moon, and they said it was simply fantastic, and of course it has been. 12 days ago, shortly after the liftoff of Apollo 15, President Nixon said, and I quote, "We hope by this journey to know better the origins of the Earth, the Moon, and the other planets. We hope to understand something more of the mysteries of God's great work. And in this seeking, we hope to understand more of man himself." And now at the end of this flight, we can look back on 12 remarkable days of adventure and scientific exploration by three remarkable men, Dave Scott, Al Warden, and Jim Irwin. We can look back on the enormous technological progress that we have seen in just 2 short years since Apollo 11. Even that pioneering venture now looks primitive by today's standards. We heard and watched two explorers at work. We were able to participate with them in a way that man had never before participated in any epic scientific voyage. And millions of people here on Earth were willing to, wanted to participate, simply because the human spirit needs and responds to the stimulation of new knowledge. We saw that the moon was not the cold, stark, foreboding, forbidding place of our first visits. Rather, our new explorers called it beautiful, spectacular. They even thought of Sun Valley when they set foot on Hadley Plain. And while listening and watching, man on Earth realized that his nearest neighbor is not so inhospitable, that someday his offspring may seek the resources of his sister planet as well as those of our own Earth. Dave and Al and Jim have indeed expanded our knowledge of ourselves and of the universe that we live in.
Mr. Myers, do you have something you'd like to say?
Well, I join all of you in being very happy that Dave and Al and Jim are home again safely. And I think we all recognize what a tremendous scientific payoff we've had out of this mission. We've been working at it for many years now, getting ready for this series called the J Missions. And we've talked a lot about what we hope to gain out of the flight. But it's a tremendous thing to see it happen in front of your eyes, with the television being with them, and to see the guys really producing the kind of science that makes this transition from exploration into real scientific output such a tremendous thing. I think the people that work in the Apollo program, the whole Apollo team, is to be congratulated again. It was, I think, the smoothest mission we've had, in spite of the problem that we had here with the parachute on reentry, which I think had us all a little nervous. But it was a great operation, and everybody did their part in the Apollo team.
The head of the Apollo team, Dr. Patrone. Yes,
sir. We're certainly all very thankful that the last 12 days have been so rewarding. I think in the annals of recorded history, Apollo 15 has certainly subscribed and engraved a legacy that these have to be considered man's greatest hours in the field of exploration. For that, I know we must all have a certain amount of both gratitude and humility that we've been able to take these steps in just 10 years after man first ventured into space.
Dr. Kraft?
Well, I'd like to congratulate the Apollo team, which was made up of both the engineering team and the science team for Apollo 15. They truly did a superb job. I think that you and the press certainly recognize the tremendous amount of planning that goes into these missions, and the planning for this one was obviously excellent and thought out very thoroughly so that we got the most out of the mission. I'd like to recall for you that back about the time of Apollo 9 and 10, we did recognize that we were probably going to be able to land on Apollo 11, and we really hadn't had the nerve to even think that we would be able to do it in that number of flights, and so that Apollo 11 and the following flights of 12 and 13, 14 were accomplished with equipment that was set really just to land on the moon. And as we went through those flights, we expanded them as much as we could to get as much science as we could. But about at the time of Apollo 9 and 10, we recognized that it was time that we really thought very strongly about what we were going to do in gathering science on the moon, and that's when we made the planning for those missions. And a number of us have been saying that that's what we were looking to, and Apollo 15, I think, is the culmination of a tremendous amount of work of the Apollo team of both engineers and scientists. In particular, I'd like to bring back the names such as Kenny Kleinkenecht and Aaron Cohen, who had such a tremendous amount of planning effort in bringing those missions about, and they certainly shouldn't be forgotten, although Kenny at this point is now in the Skylab program. I think that we've answered our critics of not doing science in Apollo, and I think this mission is probably the greatest mission that any of us have ever been associated with. We're extremely gratified with the tremendous amount of science that we've accomplished and the tremendous work that the flight crew and the people here on the ground accomplished. I'd like to also welcome another member or set of members to the lunar surface team, which was certainly the Marshall Space Flight Team of themselves and the Boeing and General Motors people who built the rover vehicle, and they certainly ought to be congratulated for such a tremendous job on the first use of their tremendous rover vehicle.
Dr. Reese?
Let me join Chris Graft in congratulating the teams who have done such a tremendous job. I want to especially also mention the team down at the Cape that launched the launch vehicle in such a great fashion and made the preparation for this tremendous mission we have now behind us. As to the Saturn V, I only want to say this, that this was the most flawless launch we ever had and the most flawless function we had in the Saturn V. After we have looked through the data preliminarily, we found almost no shortcoming whatsoever. Although the Saturn V was this time the most powerful one, it had to push the greatest payload on this mission as we had ever had one. As to the lunar rover, thank you, Chris, for the congratulations from Marshall Space Flight Center. This was quite an undertaking. We made it in 17 months. We had quite some rough going here and there, but we put our heart in it so that the Boeing Corporation and General Motors Stelco Electronic Division, and he had proven that the lunar rover is really designed obviously well, because it could stand all the rough goings on the moon much better than we ever had thought. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go now to questions. Bill Hines, please wait for the mic. I might remind you that we'll have an operational team up here after this.
I'll ask general questions. I would like to ask of George Lowe, in view of the fact that this is a moment of tremendous triumph and significance to the agency, I'm wondering if you can explain why the administrator is not here to share in it. And also for Dale Myers, your remark on the parachute on reentry had us all a little nervous. I'm wondering why, in view of the fact that the parachute system was designed to work nominally with two parachutes instead of three, why you got excited when two showed up.
Bill,
Dr. Fletcher and I decided to split up and go two different ways in most of our activities. And I won this time, and I won the Houston end, and he won the Washington end. It's as simple as that.
As far as the parachutes are concerned, Bill, the parachutes were designed to operate with two chutes. I mean, the system was designed to operate with two chutes in sea states much higher than these. And people spend their whole life working on a two-chute system, and they still don't expect to see it happen. And we just saw it happen that time. It's never happened before, and it always leaves you with a little bit of catching the breath while you're waiting for it to come in.
Reg?
Following that up, would Dr. Petrone be content to go with Apollo 16 until he finds out why this happened?
Well, certainly every time we have an anomaly, we pursue it. And I must say, from every anomaly, we learn. I don't know of one yet we've had on a program from which we've not learned. In many ways, that's what contributed to the continuing success. We're going to pursue that. We're going to be able to look at pictures of it coming in. I believe Recovery may have gotten a chute, and I'm not certain of that yet. And I know we'll, before we fly 16, we'll feel confident that we'll have three chutes at the time we deploy.
Stu?
For Rocco Petrone and Chris Kraft, as Apollo 15 ends, as the greatest Apollo mission to date, we're looking again to the end of the manned flights to the moon. I wonder what your thoughts are about this now.
Well, we've got two more missions ahead of us that certainly, are demanding our attention, are getting our attention. And I feel are also going to be great missions in terms of what we intend to accomplish. The missions are 8 and 16 months off. At the time of, our last planned mission, at this time on 17, I guess I might be able to answer that better. But at this time, with 15 in the books, we're going to concentrate on 16, knowing we've got 17 after that, both of which I feel will give us great returns in understanding both the moon and its environment and the mysteries we're searching.
You want me to answer that also? Well, having grown up with this business, as most of the people at this table have, I think we felt kind of nostalgic when we flew MA-9, and there were many of us that wanted to fly MA-10. And when we flew Gemini 12, and I'm sure we'll feel extremely nostalgic when we fly Apollo 17, because I think it has been a fantastic life as well as a fantastic success. I have hopes that what we find from the Skylab program and the shuttle will keep us all as excited, and I hope I'm around when we make the venture to Mars or wherever this country decides that its next exploration ought to be.
John?
In view of the excitement over the explorations of the moon this time, is there any serious consideration being given to extending Apollo beyond 17 or having some sort of follow-up, either manned or unmanned, program of lunar exploration?
Not at this time, John. As Chris, I think, pointed out so well a moment ago, we are excited about this mission, but it is exactly what we expected it to be at the time that we laid down the plans for Apollo 15, 16, and 17 and made the very hard decision to cancel 18 and 19. We saw what we expected at that time, namely a fantastic scientific return. We expect to see the same again on 16 and 17, but we still feel that in the overall balance of things, we will learn as much as one should learn at this time about the moon. One can always learn more, but in the balance program with these two remaining flights.
Zach?
In view of the outstanding success of 15, what will you do for an encore on 16 and 17? By that I mean, do you have any major change of plans for 16 and 17, Dale, Rocco, and I?
Changes in hardware, no. We have no major changes. In terms of sites, each site on the moon has got to be exciting. There's so few places we've been to. And at 16, we have announced we'll be going to a site known as Dakar. It's a built-up highland site. It's the first time we will be away from the Mare. And I know it's got many surprises for us. 17, we're going to still search for, based on information we get from 15, the way of photos and some of the experiments were done in the orbital science. But I think the site itself will hold, you might say, the greatest returns and surprises for us.
Right over here, and then we'll be down. Next.
Dr. Lowe, on the, I'd like to know if you intend to exert all of your influence to see that a scientist is included on the crew of Apollo 17, and would you please assess why or why not you feel a scientist should or should not be included in the final mission?
Am I going to exert all my influence? The answer is no, because as I'm sure you know, crews are selected by the Manned Spacecraft Center, and specifically by the director of the center, Bob Gilruth, who has not yet made a recommendation or a selection for Apollo 17. I'm sure that his choice will be a wise one. And if we go by past experience on the crews that have been selected by the center, I'm confident that they'll make the right choice for that particular mission, weighing all factors involved. I cannot, without having that recommendation yet, comment in any way as to what it is or what it will be or what it should be.
Okay, right down here.
Congressman Teague says that he'd like to see some funding put in for additional Apollo missions to use up the hardware that's been built already after the preliminary Skylab program. If the Congress were to provide money for that, would you want to fly those missions, or would you rather try and do something else with that money?
I'm not sure that Congressman Teague actually said that. I believe that he expressed an interest in using the remaining Apollo hardware for additional flights in Earth orbit beyond Skylab. Now, if the Congress were to provide that those funds, we would have to give very serious consideration whether in the overall balance of things, whether in looking toward the future and when we can bring in the new systems, this would be the best thing to do, but we'd certainly weigh that very heavily.
Do we have any more questions? Okay, Lou?
Not only the chutes, but there were a whole list of things that could be called minor irritants during the flight, all the way from a loose connection at the undocking. And I'd like to ask if any of you feels that this is an expression of a more casual attitude among workers, and whether you think there will be any more casual attitudes in the future.
I'd like to address that if I could. You know, when one looks at the fact we flew what is probably the most complex mission man could dream of, no less execute, and have as few anomalies as we had, I personally stand well satisfied that the basic work is sound. Now, one always will have to pursue these anomalies, whatever they are. We've got them listed. We learn from these. I personally think that the quality of the flight, when you look at those two complex ships, the LEM and the CSM, out for 12 days and back, I think speaks for itself. But from every anomaly, we pursue it, we learn from it, and the next mission should benefit from it.
I wonder if I could hear just a word on why it's felt that more Earth orbital missions would be more relevant to life here on Earth than more knowledge about the moon, which we hear has a great deal of relevance to understanding how to behave on our Earth.
I'll start it, and maybe you want to. Vic, it's a very difficult question. I think it's a question of timing and when you do what. I may be wrong, but my view in listening to the wonderful science that was done on the moon this time and in the previous times has led us to the conclusion that someday we must reach a point of diminishing returns. Now, we have sort of said that'll come after 17, and I can't say that that's right or not. We won't know it until after we've finished 15 and 16 and 17. We have not done very much in manned or unmanned flight so far about understanding our Earth better. We have learned somewhat about our Earth from the weather satellites, but we have not yet flown our first Earth Resources satellite. So we feel that the time has come that we, when we reach that point of diminishing returns, to look inward for a while, to look at ourselves with both unmanned and manned satellites, as we will do with the ERTS in 1972, as we will do with the Earth Resources Package and Skylab in 1973.
That he wanted to be around when we went back. How long is he going to have to wait before we welcome a crew back from the moon or another planet after Apollo 17?
As I've said to a number of you sitting here before, I feel that the going to the moon is much like going to Antarctica has been. And I meant by that that we first started out there in a very meager exploration, and some of the men gave up their lives, as a matter of fact, to get there. And it was very difficult to get there, very expensive, and the science you got was very exciting at first, but it was still too much of a task to get there. And I think the moon is going to be likened to that. Whenever we develop the vehicles which will allow us to carry a much higher payload to the lunar surface, where we can probably establish a base on the moon and do some real detailed exploration with men staying there for considerably long periods of time, a couple of months or more. And I think that's when we will be welcoming men back from the moon. Now, when that can happen, most engineers tend to overestimate what they can do in the next year and completely underestimate what they can do in the next 10. Hopefully, by about this time in the 80s, we will see a great deal more of what we can do in space, and I'm very hopeful and optimistic that we will have that capability.
John Lennon, then Pete Baldwin.
Question for Chris. Chris, when you have a three-chute configuration as you had today and one of them lets go, what is the potential for that one fouling either of the other two or both?
There is always that potential, particularly if the chute were to spin and get fouled up in the other lines. And I think that was a concern for us, not that the chute was going to spin, but when you are down to two chutes, then what might happen to the other two chutes, and I really think that's what Dale was referring to when he made the comments he did. The velocity really only goes from about 28 feet per second to about 32 feet per second when you lose one chute. We'll be very interested in knowing particularly what happened to that chute. If you expect to see a chute failure, you expect to see a streamer. And from what I was able to see through the television and from the meager reports I've had so far, it appeared that we had three good chutes. That was reported by the recovery crews. And then that chute seemed to deflate for some reason. So we'll be very interested in knowing why that chute deflated.
Pete?
Well, considering the tremendous orbital science inputs you got from this mission, much of which was due to having men aboard compared to what you might have gotten had it been an unmanned satellite, does this mean that you're not going to give any consideration to a possible Apollo lunar orbital flight in the future?
Well, I think that we've been through this cycle all the way through the program. I think the thing that we looked at when we decided on the J-Series missions and when we decided to cancel 18 and 19 was the fact that we were going to get a tremendous amount of science out of these last three vehicles. And we have made the decision to go forward with Skylab and to not fly 18 and 19. And there isn't anything that really has come out of this flight that would cause me to change my opinion about that, because we had expected tremendous results out of this flight and had bet that we were going to get a lot more data. We, I think, probably have made more studies of the sort of rate of increase of results that we get out of the Apollo program in these last three flights than we've ever done in any of our other planning operations. So I don't really think that anything has changed. We see the same tremendous opportunities available to us in Skylab, and we think we ought to move to Skylab from here.
Okay, thank you very much.
Captain Lee is going to have a brief opening statement, after which we'll go to questions.
Expressed from this table earlier, so why don't we go into the questions?
Let's go. Any questions? Vic?
So, Perry, where did you get that necktie?
This is second door.
Well, we may as well get this over with. I guess we should hear from Jim McDivitt if he can say anything more about the parachute problem that was so spectacularly visible to us.
I don't know any more than you do. My information came from the television and from a couple of comments that were made by the recovery forces. Apparently, we had three out, then we had two and a half out, and we hit the water. Didn't damage the spacecraft. We didn't expect it to. I'd asked the recovery forces to try to pick up the chutes if they could, but they try to do that every time anyway. We've asked to have the videotapes sent back here so we can take a look at them.
Jim, we did get one chute, but at present they don't know which. We can't identify which of one of three, but they do have recovered one chute. The other two we didn't get.
Okay, very good.
We understand that this spacecraft was really crammed with all kinds of rocks and everything under every couch. Just how much of a danger, how much danger was there that this stuff could break loose on impact and damage the cabin and astronaut or the samples? Anything.
The spacecraft is designed to withstand a 78G landing impact. We figured today we probably picked up around 16 or so. So it was well under that design. When we load things into the spacecraft, we don't just throw them in there. We run a structural analysis on every bag and every position in which we expect to put that bag. We plan this all before launch because you have to have the center of gravity in the right spot. So you have to know where each bag is going to go and how much is going to be in it. We've done all that, and then we run a structural analysis on each bag and the things that's used to tie it down. So I didn't expect anything was going to get loose, and as far as I know, nothing did.
This gentleman right here.
Have you heard any more about that Soviet ship there? What was it up to?
Maybe the crawler. You had the name, didn't you? The Russian trawler?
No. We'll come to it in a minute.
It was identified as a Russian trawler.
Oh, no. It apparently was just holding position 2 to 5 miles aft of the Okinawa, I think, during last night and this morning, and there was no interference and no intercourse. The press tells me that, incidentally, it was built in Orange, Texas, and was given to Russia in a lend-lease in 1944.
Zach Strickland.
For General Jones or some of you guys who know how parachutes perform, could you give us some kind of option as to what possibly could have caused a parachute to do the way this one did today?
There are a million reasons that parachutes do things like this, and we're just going to have to go out and look at whatever data we have. It's a million different reasons. The thing apparently got deployed, and I feel that the most difficulties come in deploying parachutes, not in once getting them deployed. So I really couldn't even guess on what happened to this.
Rhett?
I don't want to pick a nit here, but the camera helicopter with the TV in it appeared to be orbiting around the spacecraft, and when the three chutes were still floating, just nicely on top. Why does it take so long for the other guys to get down there and try to get them before they sink? By the time the swimmers got in there, two of them had sunk. Well, you see that on the tube, and yet, what are your priorities there in
well,
time
of course,
span?
The priorities are all, of course, on the crew. They initially put out a raft with a grappling hook on one of them, and this is in the whatever proper relation to the wind, so that the swimmers won't get fouled up in the line. And then they proceed with the recovery of the astronauts, and then go back and get the apex cover and the chutes. And by the time we get back, two of them are gone. The one that they dropped the raft with the grappling hook did recover that one.
You know, it's worthwhile to note that a parachute is an extremely dangerous thing when it's in the water like that, because it's like a many-armed octopus, and you just don't dive blithely into that mass of lines, and it's not worth the life of a man to recover those parachutes. Matter of fact, I think I was more nervous about the swimmer who was trying to get that one parachute than I was about the spacecraft coming down on the two chutes.
Dr. Barry, could you give us the latest update on the crew's physical condition? And some of your opinions about what you thought you saw on the tube, how they looked and acted and so forth.
Well, I guess I don't have any later word than what we've had from the crew themselves, which you've heard. And we haven't had any word yet since they were on the carrier. We won't have probably for another few minutes yet. And we'll have a transmission of all the data in five hours after the landing. So from everything we know, the crew's in good condition. They did, as I'm sure you noted, they walked with a somewhat wide gait for a little while, which is understandable. This is the longest time that we've had next to our 14-day flight. I think it does take a little while to get your sea legs back, as I think Al expressed. It takes some time to where you feel like you walk just exactly the same way, and I'm sure they probably are back to that by now, the time that they've been down in the examining area. And I think that we have a crew that's in very good shape now.
Okay. I guess this is for Mr. Schoberg. This mission's seen a far more intense interaction between scientists in the back room and the flight control apparatus. And all the scientists that we've talked to have really been thrilled by the cooperativeness of the flight controllers and speak warmly of it all the time. And some of them were wondering whether they ended up being an annoyance.
No, I don't think so at all. I haven't heard any words that would express that feeling at all from any of our people. We did a great deal of work since Apollo 14 on this science team with Jim and Tony Callio, and I guess I'm pretty pleased with the way it worked out.
Art Hill?
Could someone tell me, please, when we'll be getting our first look at the so-called Genesis rock, perhaps when the geologists open it? Is that on Sunday? We might see it on TV.
I don't think you'll see it for a while yet. They have much work to do.
Art Hill, in the third row.
Dr. Barry, did you perhaps do any measuring of heart rates in mission control this time? And if you did, can you think back and compare with previous reentries?
I don't think we had any heart rates on the reentry time that were any higher than any we've seen. We had heart rates for a little bit longer this time on the chutes. We did not have them during the reentry. We did not have them in the time that they were on chutes, however. And so we were asked earlier, I think I was asked by someone, did we see anything at the time that there were only two chutes? And we did not. We didn't have any rates at that time. But the rates were, I think the highest rate we saw was something like 130, which is expected.
I guess what I had in mind was that the rates of some of the flight controllers that are on the consoles and that sort of thing are on yourself or what?
Oh, you mean people in the... Oh, no, we did not have rates on anybody in there. Unless someone took their own pulse, I couldn't report on that, I'm afraid.
Let's catch the young man in the striped shirt there in the second row. He's been...
A couple questions. The first one for Jim McDivitt. Does the crew have any capability to detect a malfunctioning chute and release it before it can foul the two normal chutes?
No, all the parachutes are hooked together into a thing we call a flower pot, so they're either all on or all off. And they can detect it by looking out the window, although you can't really see all three chutes simultaneously.
And for Dr. Barry, did Scott Irwin and Warden show any more unsteadiness than any other three Air Force types stepping on a ship?
Gee. Well, I don't know. I have to think back to when we had three other Air Force types standing on a ship, I guess. I'm not quite sure. No, I don't think they're unsteady. I didn't mean to imply that they're unsteady. There is a tendency when you've been weightless for a period, just a period of time, even a day or so less than this, we have seen where some of the crewmen stand with, and if you remember the people at the time of even the Gemini 7 flight, they stand with the feet apart, just with a wide gait to try and balance yourself.
I didn't make myself clear. I mean, not discounting space flight or weightlessness, but just take any three pilots who are not earthbound and not used to being aboard a ship.
I don't know the motion of that ship, so that's very hard to answer, but the sea looked pretty calm out there, and I don't think there was a whole lot of motion on the ship.
We ought to make it clear that our Navy troops don't
see much sea duty these days either.
Yeah, so that's right.
Good. Good, D.
Let's take this gentleman right here and a couple more after that, and then we'll wind it up.
Just this is for McDivitt. Just to pick up on the G's, you said 78 design point. 16 today. How many G's do you get with three chutes?
Well, probably about 8 or 10. I think we probably get up around 12 or 16 today. Those are all guesses because this is going back to a bunch of empirical data we have from previous tests. A lot depends on the water landing, whether you hit flat or whether you hit with the heel first or whether you hit a wave that's coming up or going down or into the wind or away from the wind. Looks like they hit pretty flat today.
Rhett Turner.
Sort of on the light side, Deke, some of us shared, I think, the surprise that I believe you expressed yesterday at the rather distinct mustache and beards in the press conference. And I see that there, Dave, on Dave particularly, he seems to still have it today in addition to some other bit of beard. Do you think we're going to have a new mustachioed colonel when he gets back to Ellington?
Well, I can't really answer that question. They decided before the flight that they probably would not shave for the duration. However, they did have a razor on board, so they could if they chose to. So what he'll decide to do between now and tomorrow night, I really can't say.
Okay, Vic, we'll wind it up after that.
I think this is for Deke. This mission obviously presented a whole new situation as far as length of time that we were supervising these men and therefore a new intensity of interaction back and forth between the ground and the astronauts. And there was obviously some tension in that. But do you overall regard that as a success or were there some surprises or interesting things for you in that?
I'm not sure I really understood that. You're talking about the interaction between the crew and the flight control team? I thought we had an outstanding set of cooperation on this flight. We always have had, but in a mission as complex as this, it takes a little bit more of it than it has in the past, particularly in the lunar surface activities. It takes a great amount of coordination between the scientists in the back room, the flight control team in the front room, and the capsule communicators in real time, and I thought everybody in the loop did an outstanding job, in my opinion, and I think the crew would agree with me. I think they felt they really had a beautiful support.
Thank you very much.